And I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, I should probably use some of that because right now I drink myself to sleep every night. You know what? In the SEAL teams, we're not the best shooters. We're not the best drivers. We're not the best at anything, really. What we do is we go out and we find the best people in the world. We pay them money to train us to make us better. You can either suffer in the back or you can suffer in the front. More veterans kill themselves from suicide than have ever died in combat. Like, now that's my why. Like, I have suffered. I want to make that number smaller.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Warrior Poet, where we talk about making an impact through leadership. Today, I'm excited to interview Will Branham, senior enlisted Navy SEAL leader and founder of Naked Warrior Recovery. Leadership can happen through teams, but often we need to lead ourselves. And Will talks eloquently about how he struggled with stress, anxiety, and more after the military, and how big the problem of suicide is among veterans, and what he is doing to help. We talk about that and more right now. I am very pleased to bring to the Warrior Poet podcast one of the guys I've known the longest from the teams. He was my platoon chief in my first platoon as a SEAL, as a brand new guy. So taught me a lot about the teams and everything else. Will Branham. Will, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm stoked to be here.
You bet. You bet. It is a beautiful day here in the DC area. I imagine it's always beautiful where you are in Hawaii.
There's worse places to live for sure. But yeah, we just finished almost a month of rain every day. It was ridiculous. I have an unfinished pool in my backyard and it's about 9.5 feet deep and it had about 5 feet of water in it. That's how much rain we had.
Oh my gosh.
So we just got that pumped out recently. So
is it a pool big enough for a water O course? Cause I dream of being wealthy enough where I can build a water O course.
Right. But I am planning on putting a slack line across it.
Oh, I like it.
Once we finally get some water in there.
So nice.
It's on the to-do list.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Awesome, man. While we're on the subject of being in Hawaii, can you tell the folks, how'd you end up in Hawaii? Everyone dreams of getting out there from the mainland. People fear island fever, that kind of stuff. How'd you end up there?
I started my SEAL career on the East Coast. And I was detailed out to California to work in the headquarters. And then I heard about, my first team was actually a SEAL delivery vehicle team. So basically what that is, an underwater submarine that you put two guys in the front to drive and navigate. And then you could put four guys in the back and we can go different places in the world to go do things that you don't hear about or talk about or whatever. So while I was at the headquarters, I kept hearing about all these cool, super secret missions. I had no idea what they were doing. I'm like, I want to look behind the curtain. And the team is in Hawaii. So I thought the weather wasn't quite good enough in San Diego. So I needed to move to Hawaii to have better weather. And I came out here, joined the team out here, did a task unit out here. Then I went up to the headquarters. I ended up being the science and technology director for science and technology, basically solving problems, where I went out and found $16 million of other people's money to create new technologies like quantum cascading lasers, whatever that means, creating inflatable sleds that are man packable, where if we're in some place where the news doesn't really want us to be, maybe the government doesn't want us to be, and we need to, and the SDV breaks down, we need to get some boats in there to get the SDV out quickly because you can't drag that thing underwater from a surface craft very fast. But we created an inflatable sled to get it up out of the water. And so we could do about 20 to 30 knots and get out of harm's way if that was the case. And some other technologies also.
Yeah, that's and go ahead.
Yeah. And so when I retired, I decided I didn't have a place to really go back to on the mainland. So Hawaii is not a terrible place to live. And I started surfing. I really like surfing. So why not?
Nice. Although I grew up at a beach, Daytona Beach, I never got good at surfing. I still suck. It's one of those things that I really one day want to have enough time and focus, be able to learn.
I didn't say I was good at it. I just like doing it.
Do you surf the big waves out there?
I do. I try. So I generally surf on a stand-up paddleboard, which I don't know if I recommend or not. My boards have gotten very small, where you can actually surf them without a paddle. And when I stand on them, they're mostly underwater. So I've gotten pretty good at standing on really small boards. So it's easier to maneuver and things like that. And yeah, I've surfed some pretty large waves, big enough to break my boards. I've broken multiple boards out here. And a stand-up paddleboard is about 4 inches thick. So it's a pretty gnarly wave that can snap that thing to, yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy, man.
And I've probably been closer to death, you know, in the ocean here than I have in combat.
That's crazy. We talk about transitions, self-awareness, self-development a lot here, and I'm sure we'll do that more in this conversation. But I'm curious, you mentioned being the director of science and technology in essentially a combat deployable organization. What was that like in terms of transitioning that focus? What was that like mentally, psychologically? Because it's obviously very different being in that sort of role as opposed to leading a bunch of guys going to the fight directly.
It was, I enjoyed that job because I got to see, I was at the headquarters level, and I'd already spent some time at the higher headquarters. So I was at the lower headquarters level. And it was very cool because the things I was trying to solve were operational deficiencies. What an operational deficiency is, basically it's a technology or a tactic or a technique that prevents us from doing our job or going out and doing the job that we need to do as SEALs. When I moved up to the headquarters, we had a stack of these operational deficiencies that no one had really found a solution for, or no one really tracked. They just said, oh, we submitted this ODR, there was no money associated with finding a solution or anything like that, because contrary to popular belief in the SEAL teams, we don't have research and development dollars. We don't have any way to fund problem solving. There's an organization on the East Coast that does have a budget for that. The regular SEAL teams do not. No matter how special we think we are, we don't have that funding. And it's all from Congress and all this other stuff. So really what my job was, problem solving. I had to find out, like, okay, we've got this technology, we've got this capability gap. How do I solve this problem? So I just went out, I found potential vendors that might be able to solve the problem, create new technology that doesn't exist. And then once I found someone who might be able to solve the problem with promising technology, then I would go out and I'd find people with dollars to support research and development in the military or in DOD. So in that role, over the course of 3 years, it was really like the first 6 months, or really the first year, I didn't have any idea what I was doing or how I was going to figure this out. But so I would say over the course of 3 year period of time, I found $16 million of other people's money to help solve our problems. Being an end user, being an operator, being a SEAL, I was able to guide companies down the road of like how to design it, fit, form, weight, power consumption, and things like that.
That's awesome. It strikes me that kind of job is one of those jobs in the military that eventually, as a senior enlisted and a junior officer going to mid-grade, resembles a job in the private sector. It may be very mission-oriented, the personalities may be different, but a lot of the challenges that you face in terms of bureaucracy and solving those problems on behalf of other people with diverse stakeholders resembles what a lot of people younger in the workforce or even beyond are facing in their matrixed corporate organizations. So what do you think the challenges are, now that you've been out a while and I've been out a while, that you see in folks in the private sector who maybe they're not as good at solving those problems? Or conversely, what are the things that you've learned about solving problems yourself that don't necessarily apply anymore from the military, or that you have a different lens on?
So I think a lot of organizations, they get stuck in a rut and they don't think about, they think very conventionally. And as an unconventional force, special forces, SEAL teams, we have a different way that we look at things. And I think it's important to bring in an outside perspective. I tell people, I get business coaching, I do a little coaching also. And what I tell people, when people are resistant to coaching or resistant to like doing things differently, I tell them, like, look, you know what? In the SEAL teams, we're not the best shooters. We're not the best drivers. We're not the best at anything, really. What we do is we go out and we find the best people in the world, the best shooters, the best off-road drivers, the best people that know how to jump, fly canopies for free fall and things like that, parachuting. We go out and we find the best people in the world, and we pay them money to train us, to make us better. And then we take those skills that maybe we hadn't really thought about, the right way to draw your pistol or how you put your rifle into your shoulder or things like that. And we apply those lessons that we learned to the tactics and techniques that we use to go do the things that we do. So we go out and we find the smartest people, the people who don't care about how we're doing other things. They're really good at this one thing, and they think about things differently than we do. They're only thinking about, this is the right way to do it. This is the fastest way. This is the most efficient way. And the way that you can roll that into sort of corporate America is it's critical, especially when you get stuck or you think you're really good at something, but you're not, to get an outside perspective, maybe an unconventional perspective, to come in and look at it through a different lens. Look at what you're doing through a different lens, and then offer suggestions to make things better.
Awesome. Maybe we could take a step back and rewind the clock a little bit to, I don't think you and I have ever talked about this, but in terms of your origin story, how'd you come, you know, into the SEAL teams? What got you interested in the military in the first place? What other things were you thinking about? Because there's obviously something in internal motivation that people who have done what we have, professional athletes have, people who have really succeeded in performing arts have, that other people are looking to find in terms of that burning desire. Tell us a little bit about that.
I grew up in Meridian, Mississippi. There's not a lot there. It's a very small town, and it seems to get smaller every time I go back and visit. But I was in the Boy Scouts. And so I liked running around in the woods. I grew up hunting. It eventually became an instructor at summer camp where I taught. I helped run the rifle range. And I also became a Boy Scout lifeguard, which was the testing for that was pretty similar to the life-saving things that we did in BUDS. I think it was probably harder as a Boy Scout, but I always knew that I wanted to be part of some kind of elite, small unit military organization. I had no idea what that was. There wasn't a lot of Navy SEAL books out there or movies or documentaries or TV shows. There was none of that, really. I think there was the movie Navy SEALs, and there were no books that I knew about. I found some books later on, but there was certainly no one was really talking about it. The movie Top Gun was out. So at some point I decided that I think I was probably 15, 16 years old. I heard someone talk about a Navy SEAL, and it was a Navy pilot who came to a campfire that we had when I was teaching at the Boy Scout camp. And he talked about being in the military and being a pilot and all this other stuff. And somewhere someone had said something about Navy SEALs. They jump out of airplanes, they swim, they scuba dive, they blow stuff up, they shoot guns. I was like, shoot, how do I find out more? That sounds amazing. That's what I want to do when I grow up. Not really knowing what it was. And I think the movie Delta Force was out with Chuck Norris, where they're shooting rockets off the front end of dirt bikes. Awesome. I want to do that.
Who doesn't?
But I still want to do that. But so, you know, after the campfire, I went over and I talked to this young naval pilot who was going to flight school right there in Meridian, Mississippi. And I was like, I think I want to be a pilot and I want to be a Navy SEAL. He's like, oh, Navy SEALs. There was a Navy SEAL in my OCS class, officer candidate school.
Is that? Yep.
And he was the class leader because he was a prior enlisted guy. And anytime the class messed up, the drill instructor would take him out and he would do 8-count bodybuilders around the building for an hour. And then he would come back in and the guy wasn't even breaking a sweat and all this other stuff. And I was like, yeah, that's what I want to be, like, super strong and in shape and blow stuff up and shoot guns. And that's what I want to be. So he was like, yeah, those guys are legit. Fast forward another year, maybe, to the summer between my 11th and 12th grade year, the summer before going into my senior year of high school. The Navy recruiter calls me up on the phone. He's like, hey, man, have you ever thought about being in the Navy? I was like, matter of fact, I have been thinking about being a Navy SEAL, and I want to fly F-14s. And he's like, check, like, hook, set. Why don't you come on down here to the recruiter station, and I'll show you a movie, and we'll talk about it. So he showed me this super cheesy movie of guys fast roping and maybe some driving a Zodiac into the beach and, like, super not even good CGI, like, explosions of some target. And I'm like, yeah, where do I sign? I signed up in the delayed entry program. So basically, I joined the Navy before I graduated high school. Then I finished my 12th year of high school, or my last year of high school. And then a month later, I was heading off to boot camp, and I had no idea what I was getting myself into. I was super excited, and then I was terrified.
I think it's a great segue talking about boot camp, and you mentioned the pilot or the guy going to flight school who had been prior enlisted. Obviously, given my background, we talk a lot about so-called cake eater stuff in terms of the Naval Academy and what that route is. But obviously, the teams would be absolutely nothing, maybe a negative, if it was just officers there. So I'm curious, in terms of boot camp, even before the SEALs, obviously, all of us in our entry into the military, we have so many memorable experiences seared into our mind of different leaders, drill instructors, whatever. What do you think you learned about leadership in boot camp that just stuck with you the whole time? Does anything stand out or a particular experience?
I thought that I did not want to be a leader ever because they have more responsibility. They have more things to do. There's so much more expected of them. And I'm just barely getting by. I don't even know how you can like do more stuff or ask me to do more. I feel like I will fall on my face. So that's what I thought initially. But it's interesting because someone asked me a similar question. And looking back, I have never thought that I was made to be a leader. However, other people thought differently. Even in the Boy Scouts, I would think, hey, that guy is really good at being the whatever scout, whatever leader of the kids. And then eventually people put me in that role. And I'm like, I am not prepared for this. What? I guess I'm just going to emulate what that guy was doing because I like these certain things. And that has been a lot of my naval career. Like, I'm not prepared for that. Oh, okay. Now I have to figure it out.
What do you think the source of that reluctance, and then obviously you were super successful as a leader, like how should I think about that, and how should other people, let's say you're a software developer out there working for Facebook or Amazon right now, never think you want to be a leader. Obviously a lot of those people will become leaders. Like how should they internalize what you've been through and your path to leading people in combat?
So I still have what, and I had no idea what this term was until I retired, and then I had many ups and downs, but there's this term called imposter syndrome, where I don't think I'm good enough to fill in the blank, lead people, do whatever. And so I had to like come to terms with, I'm actually pretty good at some stuff, not in an arrogant or cocky way. But just in, I wasn't advanced to leadership positions I was promoted based on work that I had done and what people thought that I would be able to do this next level of job. And it doesn't matter what the job is. If someone looks at you and they say, hey, I think you'll be a good candidate to advance to the next role, you probably have the tools. You may not have all the tools, but that's just part of growing and maturing in whatever your craft is. If you are a software developer, if you're a copywriter, if you're a Navy SEAL, it doesn't matter. If you know, the position doesn't make you a leader. The things that you do in that position make you a leader. And generally, if people are put into leadership positions, it's because people believe that you have what it takes to do that role and succeed.
I love that. It's what you do as a leader that makes you a leader.
It's not a position. It's what you do when you get there.
Wise words. Talking about imposter syndrome, it's interesting because it's one of those things that you don't realize it until you get older and talk to people. And people are talking about this more, which is great, but that everyone struggles with that, unless you're some sort of psychopath or something, megalomaniac. Right. Like everyone struggles with that. So maybe we set leadership aside for a second. There's situations where no one is tapping you on the shoulder and necessarily telling you're ready for that next level or giving you that opportunity or giving you that promotion, such as transition to entrepreneurship, something like that in the private sector, or maybe it's some artistic project that someone wants to take on themselves, they're still going to face that imposter syndrome. So what things have you done to help manage that as you've transitioned to do things in the private sector?
I'm still working on it. I work on it every day. I'm like, I shouldn't be the one producing this video, or I shouldn't be the one writing this. What credibility do I have? I actually have a lot of credibility when I look back at it, or when I look at someone similar to me, I'm like, oh, he's more credible. No, I'm actually more qualified than the other person. It was easy in the SEAL teams because you were surrounded by peak performers, high performers every day. You knew what your mission was. You knew what you had, a badass team that they had your back, but they also challenged you every day. And they looked up to you. They respected you. You respected them. You didn't always have the answer. They were there to support you, even though you were there to lead them. And as an entrepreneur, you don't have that. Like, you're alone and unafraid. Like, it's the Wild West and you just got to figure it out. I don't have that team anymore. I don't have that mission. So what I found that I have to do is, I didn't play team sports when I was a kid because I, quite honestly, I'm not athletic. I'm not good at that. I don't have the hand-eye coordination. I don't have the speed. I'm just a regular guy. But I loved being in the SEAL teams. I loved having that camaraderie. I loved being surrounded by just high performers. And it didn't matter if it was like someone who was more senior to me or someone who was the new guy in the platoon. Like, they were still high performers. And there were times where I would have to go to the most junior guy and ask him, like, hey, man, how do you do this? When they were asking me how to do something else that I may or may not know. And so that was some weird leadership things that I had to navigate as a leader in the SEAL teams, like not knowing stuff. But as an entrepreneur, what I've had to do is go out and find mentors, find teammates, not necessarily people that are on my team, but find high performers that I can learn from. Because the great thing about being in the military, especially in the SEAL teams, is there's always someone who knows. There's a subject matter expert that is really good at this. In the entrepreneurial world, there are, but you have to go find them. You have to go find who your new team is, find out what your new mission is, find out what your why is, and then you can go and you can be successful. So it took me a while to figure that piece out. Like, when I got out of the military, I was like, I don't have a mission. I don't have a team. I don't have a why. I don't have, what is my purpose? Like, it was like, I think getting out of the military is quite honestly the hardest military mission I've ever been on. I would go back and be in cruising through Solder City and with stuff blowing up and people trying to do bad things to us over getting out of the military again. But now that I'm out and I've found my way and figured that whole thing out, I'm good now, but it took a long time to figure that piece out.
Well, there's,
I'm still building the team, but
yeah, there's so many great nuggets there that I won't rehash all of it because you said it all much better than me. But I don't want listeners, especially those who don't know that much about the SEAL teams or new to the Warrior Poet, to miss all of these things. I was jotting some of them down. They'll be in the show notes here. But in terms of the being a regular guy, I think that people looking from the outside in, especially perhaps with some of the notable personalities out there who are larger than life figures, they assume that everyone is this freak of nature. When in reality, I think most of the freaks of nature I went to Buds with didn't finish Hell Week. They weren't there.
They almost all quit.
At the end of Hell Week, it was the Dirty 30 in my class who had finished with starting off at whatever, 197 or something like that. 30 of us left. It was all regular dudes. Like, there was no freak of nature there. It was just a bunch of us who were regular guys. This is not.
I put a post on LinkedIn the other day. I have a picture of my boat crew from Hell Week. So I was in boat crew 3. They secured us early from Hell Week after the demo pits because we won almost every race during Hell Week. And I'm telling you, looking back at that picture, like, we're average at best. We were at, and not even everyone from that class, from that boat crew, graduated Buds. Like, one guy didn't graduate, but we were all just average at best. I was probably the slowest, weakest one because that's that imposter syndrome kicking in. But what I found is that was one of those lessons where I was surrounded by these guys that Bud sucks. It was fun for me, but it still sucks. Like, you're working and you have to overcome a lot of mental stuff. And what I found is you can either suffer in the back or you can suffer in the front. And every one of those guys chose to suffer in the front, not in the back. So That was a big lesson that I learned. And it took me a long time to figure that out and put that in the head. It's work. It sucks. You're going to suffer. Do you want to suffer in the back or do you want to suffer in the front? And we were rewarded for suffering in the front. Like we would maybe the boat would crew would start in the back of the train and we would work our way all the way up to chow to be in the front. And so that was an interesting lesson that I learned. We're totally average dudes, but we want to suffer in the front, not in the back.
It's a lot more fun to embrace the suck, so to speak. If there's a book out there, we'll link to it in the show notes, when you're in front. And yeah, you're right. I think for those who went through Buzz and made it, there were so many aspects of it that were fun and you didn't actually want to be anywhere else. And so I think this is not necessarily a rah-rah motivational podcast, but to those of you who are struggling with imposter syndrome or want to achieve that thing, certainly there are plenty of regular guys doing it all the time. And obviously elsewhere, tons of regular gals doing that as well. Talk about the finding the why, finding the mission statement. Because I tell you, Will, I remember I got out in 2008, business school till 2010. I remember the whole time for 5, you know, years after, even now, in 2021 at the time of this recording, every now and then I'll meet someone, they'll still ask me, how have you done with the transition, or how are you doing? And the question always struck me as one after I got out, reminiscent of like a post-Vietnam era, right? Where you had tons of people who never wanted to go in the military, not great onboarding and training for those people. And then they're just going right in the thick of things into terrible combat situations with lots of drug problems overseas and all that goes with it. And then they come back and their country hates them because they fought a war that they didn't even want to fight in the beginning. And yeah, that could be a really tough transition back into society. Totally get that. For me, I was like, I'm a regular guy. I was a regular guy before I went in. I never even bought into all the military stuff while I was in. I hated a lot of the military stuff while I was in. I liked where we were and even wanted more freedom to do what we wanted to do to achieve the mission. And I don't use military jargon a lot. Like, I want to do other things in life. That's why I got out, even though I loved the teams. There were other things I wanted to do. Yeah, transition's fine. I'm able to get a job, blah, blah, blah. But in reality, over the years, I realized the deeper consequences, the deeper foundations underlying that question, even if the questioners don't really realize it, which is, yeah, like finding that why statement, finding that mission is really hard. And I was telling Nat Thompson, our fellow friend, the other day that I don't have a why statement exactly, but I have found purpose in a few things that I'm passionate about achieving. How do you go from having such a, let's just call it, sacrosanct or unassailable mission that you believe in? Like you said, you've got the team, you've got the mission, you believe in it, you're passionate about it, and you like the actual functions of the job. You like jumping out of planes, you like diving, you like shooting, all those things. How have you focused your energies on something else, something tangible that can help you, help your family, help society?
So I think this also speaks back to your question earlier about leadership and things like that. And really, what I find important about leadership, and I didn't really understand it that well in the teams per se. I did a little bit. And when I was thinking about some of this stuff earlier, it came back to me. And really, I think one of the biggest parts of leadership is being of service. It's not about, I joined the SEAL teams for a self-serving reason. I want to be one of those guys. I want to do that stuff. As I grew as a leader, I found that for me to be successful as a leader, I have to be of service. That servant leadership, that kind of is a coined term that goes around. But really, and I'll go back to our platoon, the Gulf platoon, I had no idea what I was doing when I took over that platoon. And there were blocks of training that I had never done before. But I had to learn. I had to learn a lot of lessons before. Like, I had never done CQC ever. And now I'm the platoon chief of a platoon, and I'm expected to know a bunch of stuff. And I had guys ask me questions that I really didn't know. So I had to navigate like how to become better. I had to do a lot of work on the backside so that I could really serve the platoon to be the best platoon chief that you could have in that respect, or the best I could be. And I was, you know, pretty much terrified every day that someone's going to ask me a question that I didn't know. And I just had to figure it out. But as finding my why when I got out. That was what I started a consulting company to help companies navigate the military acquisition system. It's so not sexy. And I found that a lot of acquisition professionals don't even know how to work the system. So I found a little niche that worked all right for me. But you know what I found? A lot of people wanted me to just sell their thing. Like, I'm not selling your thing. I don't believe in your thing isn't ready for prime time. What I can do is I can help you. I can take your technology. If it's maybe good for the end user, I can connect you with the end user. If they find that they have a requirement or desirement for it, I can find money to bring that up to prime time so that we can take it down the road and actually create a technology that will support the warfighter. So I have that going on the side, but it was not fulfilling. Again, I didn't want to sell someone else's widget, some things that I didn't believe in. I was suffering. I had lots of, again, imposter syndrome. I had some depression. I didn't want to leave the SEAL teams. I was replying to emails the day before I retired, like still doing that job, still like coordinating and facilitating and things like that. And then I'm like on my BlackBerry and I'm like, dude, I am not in the Navy tomorrow. I was in total denial. The day before, I'm like, here you go, N6, you can have my BlackBerry back. And so I lost that mission. I lost that purpose. And so I had a fair amount of mental suffering. And as I worked through my own sort of internal healing, I found CBD and it helped me. And so as I'm trying to figure out my why, my new purpose, my new whatever, I was brought to the fact that 22 veterans commit suicide every day. I have never considered committing suicide, but I know that I have, and I've lost very good friends to suicide. I lost my dad to suicide, but I never knew that metric. And I knew how much I had suffered. Like, people are like, oh, you're mentally strong, you're Navy SEAL, whatever, dude. There's still stuff in here that I like to call it baggage. I don't call it PTSD. I don't call it anything else. I just call it baggage. I got baggage. And a lot of it is from, some of it is from combat or scenario. Some of it is just from toxic relationships outside the military. And it doesn't matter what it is. Like, people want to put their crap on you. And I say you, and it's not specific to military. It can be like whatever, a soccer mom or whatever. Like, people have stress, anxiety, they have baggage, and they don't know what to do with it. And so my why became that 22, that number 22. 22 veterans kill themselves every day, according to the VA. Like, now that's my why. Like, I have suffered. I want to make that number smaller, as small as I can. More veterans kill themselves from suicide than have ever died in combat. That's my why now. Let's fix that number. Let's make that number go away if we can. I don't know that we will. That's my why. So it took me a long time to figure that out and go down that road. Once I figured out my why, I'm able to chart a path, find a team, build a team, surround myself with high performers that help me to help other people.
That's an astounding, but really sad statistic that you cited there for everybody who hasn't heard it before. And for those who are relatively new to this issue, we'll link to resources in the show notes and what Will's doing. Will, do you want to tell us about Naked Warrior Recovery?
Yeah. So a little bit of my story is I had baggage, and Naked Warrior Recovery is a CBD company focusing on veterans and first responders to help them recover from traumatic events, physical, mental, emotional, whatever. But it's not just veterans and first responders that have these issues. It's everyone. If you're a high performer, if you just care, you're probably about something. You're probably going to have some level of stress, anxiety, things like that. So just my story is I had heard about CBD, I don't know, before it was cool. Like, you can find CBD on a street corner nowadays, like every street corner in America. But I had heard about it before it was cool. I was still in the SEAL teams. I was listening to a podcast on the way to work, and the guy talked about medical marijuana and the benefits of THC. But he's like, there's also this other molecule, CBD, and it helps with stress, anxiety, chronic inflammation, things along those lines. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, I should probably use some of that because right now I drink myself to sleep every night. Just I start off with one glass of vodka, not a shot, like a glass. And then 4 or 5 later, I turn off the noise in my head and I'm able to go to sleep. I wake up the next morning. I'm not performing at my best. That was the cycle I was stuck in. I was stuck in that cycle for my last few years in the military. And even after I retired, and I was still scared to try CBD. I'm a child of Nancy Reagan's war on drugs, just say no. Like, oh my God, marijuana, holy moly, whatever. I've still never, you know, touched THC. I still have a top secret clearance for some other work that I do. So that's not an option. I was still not sure about CBD because it was associated with marijuana. And so one day I was in Virginia and a former teammate, I had lunch with him and I said, hey, I'm going to go try to find some CBD. And this was 2019, I think, because I think what you have here in Virginia is better than what we have in Hawaii. I don't know. I have no idea. I don't know that much about it. He's like, you want some CBD? I actually have some at home. He's an Instagram influencer now. He's, you know, one of these larger than life people. And so he gave me a bottle. And then that night I slept a little bit better. I woke up and I was a little less pissed off. And I like to tell people that water boils at 212 degrees. I was living in 210 degrees. It didn't take a lot. There's one or two triggers that like pushed me right over the edge. And so, you know, what I found, I didn't feel a whole lot right away, but after about 3 weeks, I noticed that my quality of life just got a little bit better. So I went from like 210 degrees down to 205 to 200 to 190. I got out of this red zone and more like orange zone to yellow zone, never really green zone. And then another thing that I noticed is there were some pains that I had that weren't as bad. I would do like a movement and I'm like grimacing because it's going to stab me in the heart kind of pain. And what I found is it was still pain. It just wasn't the stabbing pain. It was just more of a dull pain. And then I stopped using, I ran out and then like stuff started coming back. I started going back into that red zone. And so I was like, maybe there was something to that. I don't really know. And so I tried a different brand and the needle went back down into the orange and yellow. And then I was at a business conference. And I'm like very interested in CBD. I want to learn more about it. I don't know a lot. And then there was a girl who she has a company. They're putting CBD into kinesiology tape to help with the pain topically. And the tape holds the joint or the fascia or whatever in the position that it needs to. It's super, you know, popular nowadays, the kinesiology tape. And so I tracked her down after this Q&A thing that we had. And I was like, hey, you're the CBD girl. And so she's like, yeah, weirdo stalker guy. I'm just interested. Can you tell me more about it and whatever? So she helped explain to me the difference between CBD, how dirty the industry was. The industry is like gnarly. It's getting better, but it's still pretty gnarly dirty out there. And again, imposter syndrome kicks in and I'm like, and she's like, well, do B2B or B2C or A to B? I'm like, I don't even know what words you're saying to me right now, but can we talk later? And going back to that imposter syndrome is she had enough confidence in me to think that I could start my own CBD company. And I was like, I just want to work for someone and learn about it. So she's like, just start your own company, stupid. So figure out your why. And so I did. And so I started Naked Warrior Recovery to bring the highest quality of CBD, a broad spectrum, which has all the minor cannabinoids and terpenes, but we extract the THC because there's a lot of people out there that they can be drug tested for their jobs and things like that. So I want to give them an option, a high quality CBD option to help with all their pain, stress, anxiety, and things like that.
Awesome. I actually have yet to try CBD. And by the way, I'd be remiss.
We'll fix
that. Yeah, apparently we will.
We'll fix that.
I think I get a host discount. So I'd be remiss. Yeah, B2C, B2B. I'd be remiss if I didn't plug the ABC BBD episode featuring the Boys to Men song with that lyric that has always intrigued me. And before we move on, Will, I got to ask you to explain some things, break it down for people. You'll do so better than me. You need to explain what CQC is because you referenced that earlier and a lot of folks might find that interesting.
Sorry.
And it's what attracts basically every guy to Buds. And also why Naked Warrior Recovery?
Okay, so CQC or CQB, Close Quarters Combat or Close Quarters Battle is what it was called when I first came in. And basically that is when you go to someone's house to visit them in the dark of night. And maybe they don't want you to be there. And maybe they would like for you to leave. And so you have to learn how to, as a team, how to move through a building, through and it not necessarily a house, but let's just say an apartment building, I move through an apartment building, through move through an office building safely, controlled, and take care of any threats that are presented to you. So you got good guys, you got bad guys, you got women and children, and you have to learn how to, number one, deal with people who want to do harm to you, who maybe don't want you to be there or don't want to go with you when you came there to take them in to ask them some questions. And it's a very complicated, it's really probably the most dangerous thing that we do in the SEAL teams or any law enforcement in the military period. And I was actually thinking about a leadership lesson from that. When I came in, we had this thing called a hall boss. And basically, it was a guy that stood in the middle of the room or stood in the building as the, you know, guys are moving down and clearing rooms. And he was telling people what to do. And so that's this very micromanaged way of leadership. And then there's another way that we eventually evolved to that allowed, I like to call it controlled chaos, where you give your people, you give your workers, you give your team the autonomy to go figure out the problem. Hey, go solve that problem. And they go out and they figure it out. If they need help, they will say, they will call back on the radio or on the phone or, you know, via text now in a business setting and say, hey, how do I solve this? Or I have this problem. So you have to build trust, number one, but two, you give them the ability to go solve, you give them the tools to solve the problem. And then you give them the ability to go solve that problem. Like, go figure that out, man. You got it. I believe in you. I trust you. And they go and they do a better job than you could ever do yourself by trying to micromanage or control them.
I love that. I think that trust is really something that's the trust in decentralization is something that's missing a lot in the private sector, right, outside the military.
But that's a slippery slope, wrapping this back to leadership, is you can give your team like a lot of, hey, go do this, but you still need to be engaged in what they're doing. You still need, they need to check in. You need to be a part of it. Where a lot of leaders, and I have made this mistake where I've been like, okay, go figure that out. And just, I gave them so much that they like got either out of control or I lost control of whatever they were doing. And, you know, that, so it's there's somewhere between controlled chaos and hall boss where you need to be. And it's a pretty big span, but you can't let, you know, just chaos happen. You still have to, it still needs to be controlled chaos. Okay, pull it back and let's reassess the situation or whatever it is. But yeah, certainly decentralized C2 is critical in, I think, any business.
Totally, totally.
Because as a leader, if you're just trying to micromanage things, you're, number one, the work isn't going to get done. And people are going to be afraid to make mistakes or make do things because they're afraid of repercussions or they're not doing it to your standard. My standard is make do it as awesome as you can. And then let's move on to the next thing.
A simple standard, but that doesn't mean it's easy. Explain why Naked Warrior.
So Naked Warrior Recovery. So the Naked Warrior is the predecessor to today's Navy SEAL. If you've ever seen the movie Saving Private Ryan, the beginning, the first 15, 20 minutes where the assault force is coming across the beach at Normandy is like the super, like, oh my God, cinematic marvel of combat. But what happened prior to that is the Navy went out and got volunteers for guys that could swim, and they were pretty good at demolitions. And so they put this team together. And so what these guys did is they swam, or they took little boats from the ships and then got out and swam into the beach. So they did reconnaissance of the beach, and then they swam back out into the water, taking notes on a piece of slate, or I'm sorry, on a piece of like plexiglass. And then they would get in the water 25 yards apart, measure the depth of the water so that they could build a chart for the assault force. This was before, you know, all the charts that we have nowadays, and measure the depth of the water, mark it down on their slate. And then they would dive down, look for obstacles underwater, come up every 25 yards, mark. And they would do this for 3,000 to 5,000 yards of beach a night, go back to the ship, make a chart off the findings that they had, create all this intel, give all the intel to the assault force. And then hours before the assault on Normandy, they got back in their little rubber boats under the cover of night and put demolitions on all the obstacles that they found in the water and as much as they could on the beach without getting shot, because they were taking fire from the beach. And as a Saving Private Ryan assault force was coming to shore, they blew the demo that was the obstacles that were in the water, and then the rest is history. So after that first assault, that underwater demolition team was shut down until the island campaign, when the Marines were like going ashore and their landing craft would hit a barrier reef and these guys would run off the beach, run off the landing craft with 60 pounds of gear on, and they would run across a reef and then they would drown in 30 feet of water on the other side. So they recommissioned these teams to come back out, do these recons, blow the reefs, create safe landing paths. And then they evolved and became today's U.S. Navy SEAL. So it's a little bit of heritage to us, but also the Naked Warrior is, I believe that we are all, every one of us are warriors in our own sense. It doesn't matter if you're a business exec, if you're the guy that works or girl that works at Starbucks, if you are a stay-at-home mom, we all are warriors. We have our own battles that we have to manage. And they're battles in the mind and battles of the body. And in the SEAL teams, and I know I make a lot of SEAL team references, when we go into harm's way, we put on our armor, we put on our helmet, and we go into harm's way. And sometimes that armor saves our lives. And then we come back and we take the armor off and rest and we recover and we get ready for the next mission. In life, we don't have that option most of the time. A lot of times, it doesn't matter if it's like a, we'll just call it a toxic relationship, or with a coworker or a significant other or a family member, they attack you and this pain is cumulative. They put their crap on you. They put their pain on you and you end up wearing this, they put their ego on you and you end up wearing this pain, this ego, this armor, and it just weighs you down and you never have the ability to rest or recover or heal. And so part of getting naked is taking that armor off, taking that ego off, taking their crap that they're putting on you, take that off. Like, who cares what they say? And this took me a long time to figure this out for my own self. Like, people, you know, put their crap on me, and it's not about me, it's about them. They have to deal with that. It is not my responsibility to deal with their crap. So, because it was dragging me down. So I finally learned to take my crap off, set it aside, and get naked and just become a better person, a better version of myself, so that I was able to grow and recover and be ready for the next battle, whatever that battle was.
I love that. Got two more questions for you before we wrap up. The first is there something that you've noticed you've had to deprogram from the military? There's that transition question, you know, how's it going? Are you doing okay? Getting back into society question that kind of assumes that, hey, like, we can't adapt. We're just rigid robots, people telling us what to do, which you and I know is not true at all, especially in the teams, but for the military at large and first responders, et cetera. But there are probably things that we all have to deprogram. And I think not that everyone listening to this is in the military and is in that situation, but I think by the example of that, they can maybe learn some things about themselves and their own journey in leadership or just life generally.
I think one of the things that I really had to deprogram was to, a little bit of this goes back to that imposter syndrome thing, but it is in the teams, they say, don't advertise the nature of your work and things like that. And there's a SEAL ethos. But you know what? I'm not in the SEAL teams anymore. I can tell people what I do. And I don't have to be specific about what I have done. I have lessons learned that can benefit other people. And there's a lot of people out there that have done way more or way less that have even more lessons learned. Success is a team sport. And you need a team to be successful. And maybe a team is a significant other. Maybe a team is like a bunch of people. Suffering in silence is never a good thing to do. Be proud of what you have done. It's okay to talk about it, to tell people what you've done, and build a team. I always thought that I was alone. Like, I'm in a leadership position. I have to do all the leadership stuff. I don't have to do that. I can rely on other people to help me accomplish that mission. And it took me a long time until I got out to figure that out.
Yeah. Yeah. And just even before I started this podcast, it took me a long time to get comfortable with talking about the teams in a public sphere for exactly the reason you described. A lot of people have done that publicly for a long time, made a lot of money on it. I believe we have a good community. I'm sure 99.9% of them did that with good intentions, and hopefully they're helping a lot of people. But it was really hard for me to get over that hump. It took me probably 10 years to really do that. So I totally know what you mean there, but we are who we are and we have our backgrounds, and hopefully we can help some people along the way. And then I love your point about finding a team, and it's not necessarily a team that's people who work for you in your business. It's not necessarily friends either, but it's that cohort of people who can help you along.
It's that, I forgot who said it. The top five people that you surround yourself with are the, those are the people who will make you or break you. That's the level of success that you will have. Once I learned that, I saw that and I learned that. It was easy in the SEAL teams because you're surrounded by just amazing people who want to be there and want to. So then I had, so in the civilian world, I have to go out and find these high performers to help bring me up to the level that I want to be.
Yeah, and it's a lot harder to find them. By the way, it's Jim Rohn, R-O-H-N, who for the longest time, I thought it was Jim Rome, the sports guy. Not the same guy at all. Last question is, we've got a lot of people who are interested in the subject of leadership, but maybe at various places on their journey. You talked about your experience before leading and as a new leader and that imposter syndrome along the way. Is there a big piece of advice you'd give to someone who's thinking about stepping into leadership for the first time, or maybe they've just gotten thrust in that position where they're leading people who used to be their peers now, and they're struggling through trying to figure out how to manage it all? What's important? How do I do this? How do I really look out for the team? What would be your biggest advice to those new leaders?
I would say that leadership is not a position. It's a job. It's about being of service, and you're not going to know everything. And there's a lot of people, and I learned this over and over in the SEAL teams. There were times where I was in charge of a guy who was, no kidding, a doctor, and he was just a regular enlisted guy, and a guy that was a rocket scientist, regular enlisted guy. I'm like, I am not qualified to be in charge of these people. Your team has knowledge. And as a leader, your job is to find out what knowledge they have, find out what skills and talents they have, and use them for what they have. Your job is to serve them, not to lead them or tell them what to do. Your job is to empower them to do what they can do to the best of their absolute ability. And if they need help navigating whatever obstacles come in their way, your job is to help them navigate that problem. It's not to tell, leadership is not about telling people what to do. It is about taking care of people, and it's about giving them the tools that they need to make the organization successful.
I like to say here that leadership is a profession. It's not that you happen to be a leader, but you're a computer scientist or you're an operations person. That leadership really is its own specialty in its own right. And you don't even need to be the highest paid person necessarily. You don't need to know the most, like you said earlier about the SEAL teams bringing in the parachuting expert, bring in the shooting expert. You don't have to be the best at any one of those skills in the beginning, but you learn. And then the leader is the one who brings it all together in the end and gets the best out of everyone. But you can't lead on the side. You have to take it seriously as your main job and really serve those people, because otherwise you're just halving it. And
you can't dabble.
You can't dabble in leadership. This has been great, Will. It's been a great pleasure catching up, and you've given people a lot of insightful nuggets. I think what you're doing in Naked Warrior Recovery and for the suicide problem generally is a very worthy mission, my friend. Where can people find you?
So I'm on Instagram at Naked Warrior Recovery, all one word. My website is either nakedwarriorrecovery.com, but I also made it NW for Naked Warrior Dash Recovery, because I didn't know if people wanted to write naked into their search engine. So NW-recovery.com if you don't want to write naked into your search engine there.
Yeah, don't do that at work.
Frowned upon.
A little bit frowned upon. And that concludes my interview with Will Branham. If you liked this show, keep in mind there are plenty more like it coming, so don't forget to subscribe, and I would love if you would leave a review in iTunes. It would mean so much. It'll help us keep going and help us know what we're doing well. Also, the plague of veteran suicide is a societal problem we should all care about. These ladies and gentlemen served our country well, helped us all stay safe, and it's our job to look after them in their time of need. So please do check the show notes. I will surely include some charities you might consider donating to or participating in. Till next time. You've been lying awake in the breeze, you said, do you want me? Warrior Poet is a property of Rainiac Productions. If you like The Warrior Poet, there's more great content on Instagram. Follow Shri, The Warrior Poet, on Instagram. That's S-R-I, The Warrior Poet. You can also get to know me on a personal level by following Shri, actually, on Instagram as well. The Warrior Poet is produced by Laddie, with special contributions by Spoonman and me, Shri.
No, Kevin. Mina dua. Spita.